why is this hearing being held at all in front of the medical regulatory body of the United Kingdom? And who brought the case? And what is the case? And the case, it seems, on the face of it, was brought by a single complaint by a freelance journalist from who'd been working for the Sunday Times and others, and had been trying to uncover some misdemeanor on our behalf at the Royal Free in the investigation of children with regressive autism, with bowel problems, many of the parents of whom said that their child regressed after the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. And I'll just take you back, because when I began this work, 1995, parents approached me and said my child was developing perfectly normally. They had their MMR vaccine, I wasn't anti-vaccine, I took them along, they had their vaccine according to the routine schedule, and then the lights went out. Their eyes glazed over, they lost speech, they lost interaction, they stopped playing with their siblings, they never smiled, they were grizzly, and eventually, having lost skills and become mute and self-injurious, they were diagnosed with autism or atypical autism. And I said, I'm terribly sorry, I know nothing about autism, how can I possibly help? And they said, well, my child has terrible bowel problems, diarrhea, pain. I know they're in pain. They can't tell me they're in pain because they've lost the ability to speak, but I know they're in pain. My instinct as a mother tells me my child is in pain. They're screaming, they're drawing their knees up to their chest. It's particularly bad when they have to go have their bowel open, they're losing weight, they're failing to thrive. And the doctor says, your child's autistic. That's just the way it is. Well, that's not just the way it is. That's not what autism is. These are children who are sick. They're clearly unwell. So we put the autism to one side and we said, how do we manage these children if they had these symptoms and they were developmentally normal? And we would investigate them. And so we decided we would. And over the course of many months, we put together a protocol, a clinical protocol for the investigation of these children. What investigations do these children need in order for us to unearth the origin of their problem? For example, do we do a colonoscopy to investigate their bowel problems? Are the bowel problems linked to the behavior? Because the parents were reporting us that when my child's bowel is bad, when they're in pain, their behavior is terrible, they can't concentrate, they're at their worst in autistically, and all their autistic mannerisms get worse when they're intestine is bad and get better when their intestine improves. And this was intriguing to us as gastroenterologists, because we'd seen this before in other gastrointestinal diseases, that there are gastrointestinal inflammatory diseases like celiac disease or bacterial overgrowth, when you lose a lot of your small intestine and you're just left with a little bit behind, where bowel bacterial overgrowth leads to deterioration in behavior, what's called encephalopathy, and often progressing even to coma. And the way you treat that is to treat the bowel, get rid of the bugs in the bowel, and the behavior improves. So we'd seen it before, this gut-brain link, something in the bowel affecting the brain, and treating the bowel helping the brain. So why was this different? Was this a similar process? Was, for example, there some form of intoxication, some bacterial byproduct coming from the intestine and injuring the brain, rather like drinking alcohol? You drink alcohol, it gets through the gut, and it injures the brain, or it affects the brain, it affects behavior. And so this was no different. It's not difficult, it's not rocket science, very, very straightforward. It was something going on in the gut primarily and then injuring the brain. So this was an entirely reasonable idea to look at. The other thing is that these children had regressed in the face of a viral insult. They'd been given a live viral vaccine. They'd been given viruses which were known to be able to infect the brain and cause inflammation in the brain and to cause, for example, autism. So it was entirely appropriate that they would undergo a series of investigations. And we combine that in a single protocol with some experimental investigations. In other words, could we find in a laboratory setting evidence of measles virus in the inflamed intestine? Research. So combining, as we should do in an academic institution like the Royal Free, clinical investigation with research. And as we progressed through the process, therefore thereby refining the clinical investigations, this is necessary, that isn't, this is telling us something, this isn't, out that goes, and then refining the process so that we were getting the maximum amount of information from investigating these children for the minimum inconvenience and risk to the child. And that's just good medicine. So during this process, I was approached by some lawyers who were acting on behalf of these children, investigating the parental claim that their child had regressed, disappeared, become autistic after a vaccine. And they said to me, would you help us? You have an interest in Crohn's disease and measles virus, measles vaccine. We're now seeing these new children. What do you think? Should you, you know, can you help us in this process? And I thought about it. I thought long and hard about it. And I decided that I would. And I later wrote to my colleagues explaining my reason for doing so. And my feeling was this, and it was very straightforward, is that vaccination is designed for the greater good, to protect the majority. And it does so at the expense of a minority. And that minority of children are those who are damaged by the vaccine. And that, we don't know the size of that number, because it's never been investigated properly. But nonetheless, even if you accept that that's a permissible ethical approach, that we can protect the majority at the expense of the minority, then that minority are a group of children who have paid the price for protecting the rest of society. And therefore, society has an absolute moral and ethical obligation to care for those children for the rest of their lives, period. That's it. There is no escaping that moral imperative. And yet, to acknowledge those children in a public health setting is to raise doubts about the safety of vaccines. And therefore, it is much better to put them in a corner and forget about them, to pretend they simply don't exist. And that is what had happened to these children. The studies that had been designed to look at safety had been designed in such a way as they would never capture these children, nor did anyone want to capture them, nor was anyone interested in the parent's story when they said, my child regressed after a vaccine. They were just put in a corner, told it couldn't happen, and never investigated. And that was absolutely unacceptable. So the other thing that happened around the same time is a parent called me, and she was a mother of two autistic children from the Midlands, and she was an older parent. And she had a husband who was older than she was, and was infirm, and she herself had arthritis. And she called me one day and she said, Dr. Wakefield, please don't be judgmental. Don't judge me harshly, she said, but when I die, I'm taking my children with me. And I thought long and hard about that, and I wasn't in any way judgmental. In fact, quite the opposite. I was struck. She said to me, Dr. Wakefield, nobody else cares about my children. I'm the only person who loves them. And when I die or become infirm to the extent that I can no longer care for them, then they're going to be lost. They're going to be on the street, and they're going to die on the street because the world doesn't care. And she was quite right. She was absolutely right. There is nothing for these children. I mean, you'll know that in the sort of Thatcher era, all the long-stay institutions, the old asylums were closed down and turned into luxury apartments, and there's nothing left. It's care in the community. What does that mean? Care in the community means just shoving people with long-term mental disabilities out into the community where they can injure themselves or injure other people or whatever. Who knows? Who follows them? Who cares? And that was the future for these children. So I decided at that point that I would help the lawyers, because if nothing else, I was in a position to look at this scientifically, objectively, and provide an answer that would or would not take this story forward, but would nonetheless give these children access to the due process of justice. And that is what they had been denied. And so it was about access to justice. And surely that cannot be denied anyone, you would think, in a civilized society. So the lawyers asked me what we should do. How would you go about, in a scientific context, taking this to the next step, determining whether this temporal association that the mother has made between her child's exposure to this vaccine and regression, how would you then further link that, if possible, to the virus? And I said, well, the bowel disease that we've seen in these children and in Crohn's disease looks like an infectious disease. And you would look for evidence of the virus in sites of infection, or obvious, you know, swelling of the lymph glands is one site in the intestine that you would think. It's either like swelling of the tonsils when you get a sore throat. You would look in the tonsil for the organism that was causing it. So if you've got swelling of the lymph glands in the intestine, look in there for evidence of the virus. And measles was a virus that was known to cause this kind of swelling of the intestinal lymph gland. So it made logical sense to look in those areas. And so we set up a study. I was asked to design a study that would take this to that level, that we would get funding from the Legal Aid Board, hypothetically, and then we would look for evidence of the virus in the intestine. And after a series of exchanges and a protocol was prepared, we received acknowledgement of funding from the Legal Aid Board to conduct that study. If it was negative, it was negative. If it was positive, it was positive. Either way, it got published. It was not designed to produce a particular answer. It was just designed to produce an answer. Is the virus there or not? Didn't make it causation, but it was a crucial piece of the jigsaw that took it to the next level. Well, interestingly, the dean made contact with me. The dean of the medical school, Professor Ari Zuckerman, world-renowned virologist and expert in hepatitis B, worked very closely with the World Health Organization, was deeply involved in hepatitis B vaccination, a great advocate of hepatitis B vaccination. Different story. But nonetheless, there he was in the general apparatchik of the vaccine advocates. And he said to me that he had been contacted by the Department of Health and by certain members of the Royal College of Child Health, who had made him aware that of this funding. And I said, yes, this is a grant that we've got from them, and it's perfectly respectable, and we're conducting the science. And he said, there's a conflict of interest. There's a clear conflict of interest. And I couldn't understand that. Why? Why was there a conflict of interest? I had no conflict of interest. I was asked to take this grant, to conduct a piece of science, and give an answer. That wasn't a conflict of interest. The funding would be disclosed in the paper that wrote up this science, that the funding came from the Legal Aid Board, but beyond that, where was the conflict? Anyway, I wrote back to him and said, your suggestion that there's a conflict of interest has exercised my mind greatly over the last several months, and I cannot see where it lies. And I laid out for him the context of my discussions with the lawyers and the work that was to be done. And he wrote back to me and couldn't precisely define what the conflict was, but talked about if a legal action was anticipated and preliminary discussions had already taken place, then there was a conflict. And that really didn't make a lot of sense to me. I wrote back to him again and reiterated that we'd been asked to undertake a piece of science that wasn't seeking a particular answer. I wouldn't have got involved in the first place if there was any effort at coercion or demanding that we own the data. They didn't own the data, the lawyers didn't own it, and we would do what we felt was scientifically appropriate with it. And I have every faith in the lawyers. They seem very concerned, genuinely concerned for these children. They weren't in any way ambulance chasers. But nonetheless, there was some clear problem for the dean in this, and he ultimately refused to take this money, and I said, send it back to the Legal Aid Board, send it back. We don't want it. You know, if you're not going to let us do this, then we won't do it. And anyway, one of my colleagues said, we'll put it into an account in the hospital, a charitable account in the hospital where grants were run, and let's see if that's okay. And so we did. Now, interestingly, the dean has just appeared as a witness on behalf of the prosecution at the General Medical Council. Professor Ari Zuckerman, now 7 years retired and clearly deeply frustrated that he should be dragged out of retirement to have to give his evidence on this case. But nonetheless, his first foray was to say that, yes, when this money was transferred by the accountant of the Royal Free Hospital Medical School, it was too late. I didn't know about it. It had already happened. I couldn't stop it. It's interesting that he actually signed the check for the transfer. Surprising, that. Given the fact that it had already happened by the time that he knew about it. Nonetheless, you know, an interval of 11 years can cloud one's mind, one's memory of things. And there we are. But that was just the first error that he made. What he disclosed, interestingly, to me during that period is that he had written to the Ethics Committee of the British Medical Association to take their advice, how to deal with this perplexing issue that was clearly causing him concern about a conflict of interest that he was unable to really articulate to me. So he wrote to the Dr. Armstrong at the BMA's Ethics Committee to ask their opinion. And in it, unbeknown to me at the time, he had said that he had been contacted by the Department of Health, who said to him that the government stood to be sued by the parents of children affected by the MMR or apparently affected by the MMR vaccine, and that this, to him, was a conflict of interest, that the government was going to be sued. Now, you have to understand, I came into this with the lawyers believing that the case was against the vaccine manufacturers. The government didn't even come into it. But he was clearly under the impression that the government were going to be sued. He also said that this may be embarrassing for the medical school. Now, we were never party to the response, the ultimate response of Dr. Armstrong from the BMA. We were never told about it. All he did when he wrote back to me is to say, you will know that I have taken advice on this matter from the British Medical Association, and leave it at that, as though the British Medical Association had ruled completely against it. When in fact we got the documents, which we did do as part of the disclosure for the GMC, there it was, the letter from Dr. Armstrong, not only endorsing the fact that this study could and should be done because it was morally and ethically proper that it should be done, but that not to do it because it was embarrassing to an institution or because it meant the government might be sued was not a sound moral argument, his words. So in other words, the BMA's Ethics Committee had said, this is fine. It said that actions of this kind or research of this kind is often funded by a group with a particular interest. Of course they are. The Multiple Sclerosis Society funds research for multiple sclerosis in the hope that it can make patients better. Of course they are. So here we have another group of people with a vested interest funding a piece of research. And as long as it's ethical and as long as it's conducted in a way that it's published, whether it's positive or negative, then that is fine. Nonetheless, Professor Zuckerman did not get the answer that he wanted. He never disclosed that to us. He just kept beating us over the head with the certain knowledge that he'd contacted the BMA and they had given him an opinion. Well, sometime later, when I was working with the lawyers, that sort of faded into my distant memory. I was called by Richard Barr, one of the lawyers, and asked if I would attend a meeting on Newcastle Station with a doctor calling himself, a man calling himself George. We knew nothing more about it than that. They had a previous meeting with George on Newcastle Station. And the bottom line is, on a Sunday, we got on a train, went up to Newcastle Station, and there we met with George. And George would be wearing a red carnation. And indeed, George was wearing a red carnation. And we met with George. And George turned out to be the name of his son, who was an actor. And George turned out to be Dr. Alistair Torres, who was from the Scottish Department of Health. And Dr. Torres had been seconded onto the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation, effectively from Canada, and he had been brought in, at least in part, to advise on the introduction of MMR vaccine. Now, the experience in Canada was that they introduced a vaccine which contained a mumps component made up of a strain of the vaccine called Urabi. It was originally generated in Japan. And they had run into problems with this vaccine. It produced meningitis in children. The mumps virus was identified in the spinal fluid around the brain of the children. And the vaccine was pulled in Canada. It was pulled, it was stopped in 1997. Nonetheless, this was the vaccine that was intended to be introduced in the UK a year later, 1988. Did I say 1997? 1987. It was the vaccine that was to be introduced in the UK in 1988. They changed the name. The vaccine was identical. So it had gone from Trivirix to Pluserix in the UK, an identical vaccine that had already been withdrawn for safety reasons in Canada. Now, Torres advised the JCVI not to introduce this vaccine because it was not safe. He was overruled. He had said that, well, if you are going to introduce it, then you should have active surveillance. That is, doctors or people going out there and asking doctors, have you seen any cases of the following in the last month? Not waiting for doctors to spontaneously report, because spontaneous reports pick up 1 to 2% of the true adverse reactions. And that is, these are data from the Food and Drug Administration in America. It's inadequate, totally inadequate. And they were overruled. No active surveillance. So they're going to introduce a vaccine that has been withdrawn in other countries, known to be unsafe, and they're going to have no active surveillance for possible adverse events to that vaccine in this country. Now, this was done, he said, for competitive pricing reasons. The strain of the vaccine that contained the dangerous mumps component was one quarter, approximately, the price of the American vaccine, MMR2, made by Merck. There had been no reports of meningitis using the Merck vaccine, which contained a strain of mumps called Geraldine, derived from the daughter of the guy who actually isolated it in the first place, Morris Hillerman. So what we had was a cheaper vaccine that was known to be dangerous. So when the vaccines were licensed, or when there was the proposal to license this vaccine in the country, the joint committee or members of that committee went to SmithKline Beecham and said, we want your vaccine. SmithKline said, well, we're not happy about this because this has already been withdrawn in Canada. It's got this mumps component in, which is dodgy. They said, if we're going to do it, then we want an indemnity. We want indemnity from prosecution for damage to children on the basis of the receipt of this vaccine. And it appears that that indemnity was granted. And Torres told us about this. And he said that at the meeting, the girl there from SmithKline Beecham said, we are immunizing the children and the government are immunizing us. So they entered into this relationship. The vaccine was produced, the vaccine was licensed, the vaccine was given, and cases of meningitis started to appear. They were recorded and documented in the minutes of the JCVI, which are now available online and have been obtained by us as part of this litigation. More and more of these cases started to be reported. The Scottish Department withdrew this vaccine, didn't want to give it. Certain health areas rejected the Urabi-containing vaccine, but still, the JCVI continued with it. There was no withdrawing of this vaccine until finally a study was grudgingly done in Nottingham where they found that there was a much higher risk of this meningitis with this vaccine than had previously been predicted by passive surveillance, and the vaccine was withdrawn overnight. And it was only overdrawn overnight because it was leaked to the press. It appeared in a newspaper and suddenly the vaccine was pulled. So a dangerous vaccine, a knowingly dangerous vaccine, was introduced and ultimately proven to be dangerous and had to be withdrawn in 1992. So two of the three vaccine brands that were introduced in 1988 had to be withdrawn for safety reasons. And yet Dr. Salisbury, in his statement to the General Medical Council, sums up by saying this is a vaccine with an exemplary safety record. But if that's his idea of an exemplary safety record, then we have a very, very different perception, he and I, of vaccine safety. And so we come full circle now, because it turns out that the Dean was right. Ari Zuckerman was right. Based upon the information that he got, he says, from Dr. Salisbury way back when these parents started coming to us in 1996, 97, that it was the government that was going to be sued. I thought it was going to be the drug companies, but it wasn't. Why was it the government? Because the government had given the drug company an indemnity against harm. And so this is why we're here. This is what this is all about. This whole General Medical Council affair, an effort to discredit doctors questioning the safety of the MMR vaccine, has come about because of an indemnity given to the drug companies all those years ago for the introduction of an unsafe vaccine by perhaps just a few members of the Department of Health, or recommended by the Department of Health to the government, such that a vaccine was introduced. And when you ask now, and people have asked, was there an indemnity? Is there any indemnity? There's no. The answer is absolutely categorically from David Salisbury, time and time again, there was no indemnity, no letter of comfort, nothing at all. By the government or the Department of Health or the National Health Service for the vaccine manufacturers. And yet, in the minutes of the JCVI, as late on in the story as 1997, there is an entry there that says, it talks about the various brands of vaccine that are available, and it says that SmithKline Beecham continue to sell the Urabi strain vaccine without liability. There it is, in black and white, in their own document. And I have been every which way around that statement and cannot reconcile it to anything else other than the fact that there was and remains an indemnity. And so I'm afraid that this is really the origins of this whole process. And the hope that one could, that my colleagues and I might be discredited before this information ever became public. And in an effort to protect that original decision, that original flawed decision, and the consequences that have flowed from it, then we find ourselves in this position now. And that's fine. But it's not going to stop the truth coming out. And you would think, under those circumstances, having withdrawn this vaccine in Australia and Canada and Japan and the United Kingdom, that would be it. They ditch it. They get rid of it. Because it's not safe. But no. They go on making it. And what do they do with it? They ship it out to the third world. And there was a mass vaccination campaign in Brazil in the 90s, where they gave ostensibly the great majority of Brazilian children a revaccination with MMR during a very short space of time with the Urabi-containing vaccine, which they knew to be dangerous. And what it produced was an epidemic of meningitis, a huge peak in the number of cases of meningitis. And there was a paper written about it afterwards. And one of the points in the discussion of the paper that came up was perhaps it's not a good idea, in effect, to do mass vaccination campaigns because it reveals the true incidence of side effects to a vaccine. Well, who wrote that? Who, in God's name, wrote that? Absolutely. So this is the, if you like, the morality, the integrity of the people you're dealing with in this. Why is that vaccine even on the shelf? Why is it being sold at cut price to third world countries? What's the thinking behind this? Because it's certainly not a moral imperative. It must be a commercial one. And so that's why we're here, and that's why we'll remain here, and that's why we'll continue to fight this kind of thing. Because you can't treat people as expendable. You can't damage them and put them to one side. And Adolf Hitler in Mein Kampf once wrote, the greater truth excludes the lesser. And these children are the lesser truth in the world of, or the mind of people like Adolf Hitler. And that kind of thinking failed in the 1940s. And it's going to fail now. You cannot treat people in a civilized society as expendable. Yes, there may be an argument for a vaccination program that protects the greater good. But that does not mean that you can render those who are damaged, just consign them to the dust cart because they're an inconvenience, or their mere presence undermines public confidence. Better to keep them hidden away. And there are too many of these children now. They won't be hidden away. And parents are getting very, very angry, and they've every right to be angry. And the truth will come out. And it's going to be a very, very, very painful truth when it does come out. And the tragedy is it's going to damage public confidence in vaccine policy across the board. Because people will say, we don't believe you any longer. We don't trust you. You lied to us. And when that happens, and all vaccination policy is compromised as a consequence, the whole pillar of public health comes tumbling down. And a lot of trouble is going to ensue, because you're going to deal with a population then who are not protected from these infections. And we're going to run into big problems. And that, the responsibility for that, lays squarely at the door of the public health figures and their commercial partners who have allowed this to happen. There have been some slightly difficult moments about differences of opinion, for example, with Richard Horton over conflicts of interest. And it's been interesting, the Lancet statement on conflict is, anything that would embarrass you if it were later disclosed. And my involvement with the Legal Aid Board didn't embarrass me at all. And it wasn't relevant, in my opinion, to disclose it in the Lancet paper, because they didn't fund any of the Lancet paper. They funded a subsequent virological study, as was always intended. But it had been misrepresented in the media that they had funded the Lancet study and it wasn't disclosed. And this was the perception that Richard Horton originally had. And when I was asked about this by him way back in 2004, I said, no, they didn't fund this study at all. They funded a separate study. And he said, oh, well, in that case, it could be a potential or perceived as a potential conflict of interest. And I said, well, where did that come from? The statement, as I read it in the Lancet, the requirement is to disclose things that might embarrass you if they emerge later. And it was interesting because within that document, which was self-contained, anyone writing a paper for the Lancet would just need to read that. And the actual statement is the test of conflict of interest at the Lancet is an easy one. Anything that would embarrass you. And so you don't go beyond that. It's a self-contained document. Why would you go any further? But there's a list, there's a website flagged up in there where you can go to that website, and there is a more a broader description of conflict of interest, which does include potential conflicts of interest or perceived conflicts of interest, which no one ever went to. Why would you do it? You've got it in front of you there. Now, there's a very, very big difference. Anything that would embarrass you is the active mood. Okay, it's what would embarrass me. So I can think, well, what would embarrass me? And I can make a decision about that. What others might perceive to be a conflict of interest is myriad. It goes on forever. You have to put yourself now in the third person and think, well, what might someone else, with their various views and biases, construe to be a conflict of interest? And that's massive. Where does that end? So that is a huge conceptual leap in terms of what you would disclose. And there was no formal way for doing it at the time. Now you have a document that you fill in the boxes saying, no shares, no this, no that. That's very straightforward. But in those days it wasn't. It was highly ambiguous. And it was always my intention and always was disclosed when there was direct funding for a study from a grant-giving body or, in this case, the Legal Aid Board. And so in the viral study, it was disclosed. This study was supported in part by the Legal Aid Board, and Dr. Wakefield has acted as an expert in the MMR litigation. That's an easy one, out it goes. But in the Lancet study, I felt no need to disclose it at all, nor did any of my colleagues who knew that I was involved with the Legal Aid Board and on behalf of some of these children. So that was a difficult moment, but it was a difference of opinion. He thought I should have disclosed it. I felt at the time that I didn't. Now, in retrospect, having seen this new document about perceived conflict, yeah, I can see that that should have been disclosed. But there was no dishonesty, and he was good enough to say there was no intent to deceive. when asked, Dr. Waitman was asked about it, he was entirely open, said yes, there was this grant. We got into an argument, a debate about what was and what wasn't a conflict of interest, but there was absolutely no intent to deceive, and the charge is dishonesty. So he was extremely helpful in as much that he said, no, this was not dishonest. This was a genuine difference of opinion. And so that then largely resolved. It's a very good question on a very broad front, because they've got some tough decisions to make. One on the at the level of the case itself. And have they misinstructed their experts, and are they going to have to retrench in a different set of charges, and they've got to take time to structure those charges and get a response from their experts? Are they going to be allowed to do that? I don't know. But it must be becoming obvious to them now that much of the original information that they were given had been misconstrued, and basing their charges on that information has been in error. At another level, they're under big pressure from the Department of Health. And David Salisbury in particular has been calling them on a regular basis, urging them to prosecute this case more vigorously against me, be nastier, be meaner, throw more in. And I know this because we get sent the unused material. And so I took the opportunity. He didn't know this. I mean, you get all the telephone conversations, all the records of conversations between people, all the draft reports, which is an interesting advantage to us. So I was able to write to David Salisbury, and I was able to say, I am now in a position to have read the unused material from the General Medical Council, and I note your entreaties to them about this case. So he wrote, he was furious, and he contacted the GMC and said, I didn't know they were going to get the unused material, and you never told me, and this is a disgrace. And the wonderful thing about that is, of course, we get the documents of that telephone conversation as well. So you can see that they are under a great deal of political pressure to prosecute this case. And it's interesting that in the public domain, Dr. Salisbury has said, we don't want this to be seen to be a vendetta on the part of the Department of Health. So, mixed messages. One for the GMC, one for the public. And then the other debate, the other dilemma they have is, who do they represent in the end? Because the GMC have historically stood for the patient, the patient's rights, the patient's welfare, the patient's protection from, for example, medical malpractice. Well, who do they stand for now? Because we stand for the patients. Everything that we have done is in the best interest of the children. What they're representing and prosecuting is a case not on behalf of the children. No parent has complained against us, but on behalf of the Department of Health. In other words, on behalf of public health. On behalf of this new kid on the block, the greater good. So here we have a body that has traditionally represented the patient, the victim, if you like, against the medical profession or against medical malpractice. Now they're defending the diktat of public health against the rights of the individual. So they're in a real quandary, or if they're not, they should be, about quite who they represent. Because I know who I represent, and I represent the individual patient. Well, the charge of causing children to undergo lumbar puncture is because of the position of an asterisk in the timetable of the tests for the children. And I undertook, because it was an increased burden of work for the Department of Pediatric Gastroenterology, I undertook to just book the tests for the medical, the MRI, the magnetic resonance imaging of the brain, and the electrical recordings of the brain, the EEG. So I would just book it with the department. I wasn't ordering the test. That was done by the clinicians. I was merely functioning as a clerk, if you like, just taking the form down, signing it, and booking the appointment. Nothing more than that. The asterisk is for an MRI on Monday. underneath the MRI, also on a Monday, is a lumbar puncture, and therefore they've assumed that that asterisk applies to the lumbar puncture as well, and that I am causing that child to undergo a lumbar puncture. So there's this whole string of charges about me causing these children to undergo lumbar puncture, which was a clinically indicated procedure advocated by the clinicians, only because the asterisk is in the same box. That's the basis of the charge, at least as far as we can see. The lumbar puncture was in fact due to continue directly after the colonoscopy because the child was already sedated for the colonoscopy. So rather than give them two sedatives for two different procedures, give them one and allow it to continue over so that they were sedated when they had the lumbar puncture. So there was no need to arrange it. It was already going to be done. I did not cause the children to undergo lumbar puncture. But that's the forensic evidence that they have for making a charge. Well, wow, great. That doesn't stand up to much scrutiny. And the birthday party, there are two mistakes about the birthday party. One was taking blood from children at a birthday party, or having blood taken from the children at a birthday party. And the other was telling the story about it in a way that was designed to tell people, an audience of parents of children with autism and professionals, about my children's contribution to these investigations. I was proud of them, but I also wanted to temper that by illustrating the mercenary nature of children. And so the story itself was a gross exaggeration. There were actually nine children at the birthday party who gave blood with fully informed consent. There was absolutely no problem. In the story that I tell, then, you know, children were fainting and all this sort of thing. It was a stupid story. Humor is in the moment. I thought it was funny at the time. It wasn't funny then. It isn't funny now. But nonetheless, there it was. And the children were absolutely fine. Yes, I paid them £5 each. Or rewarded them £5 each for their altruism, for their willingness to participate in this. It was done in a perfectly respectable way, and there were no problems. And they were all entirely willing, and all their parents had given fully informed consent. And children are often altruistic and will help out. And my children, who were some of those children involved in that, knew the autistic children. They knew what it was all about. These children came to stay with us or have lunch with us when they'd come over from America, for example, and they were more than willing to help. My son Sam has just come back from teaching in an autism camp in Aspen, Colorado. You know, that is, my children have a tremendous sense of duty and caring, and they had no problem, nor did their friends at the time, about giving a sample of blood for this test. So it was a grossly exaggerated story, and that's a shame, but it should never have been told in that setting, and you could reasonably argue that it would bring the reputation into disrepute, and that is what they have argued. The ethical side of doing it, or at least the lack of ethics committee approval, there was no approval to do it. And nor did I think approval was necessary, because it was done away from the Royal Free, it was done off-site. It was done in a domestic setting, if you like. That was naive, and nowadays you would definitely need ethical committee approval, and you probably did then. I didn't know about that, and I wouldn't have told the story, obviously, if I'd been aware that it was a problem or had been a problem at the time. So a combination of naivety and a bad sense of humour. But there was absolutely no abuse of the children, and they were all very, very happy, and would do it again any time. Not that they did, but they would do it. So it's just one of those things. And if ultimately that's what they find me guilty of, then that's a small charge in my mind compared to the much graver charge of having conducted dishonest and inappropriate research on children with autism. I'm dismayed by the way in which the media continuously, despite whatever you tell them, reiterate the same errors, the same mistakes. But of course, the major problem is with the way it was handled by the Sunday Times and Brian Deer. And that, to my mind, was just a big error from start to finish. And it's like having 5% of the documents and making a story out of those 5% when you haven't got the remaining 95% that tell the actual story. Making it up, fixing that idea in your mind, staying with that idea, irrespective of what anyone might say in mitigation. And that's what happens. I think it's really a question for the prosecuting counsel. I don't know. And I suspect it may go to the quality of the charges themselves, the reliability of the charges. How do you construe a charge out of you caused this child to have a lumbar puncture? What does that mean? You didn't do it. You didn't order it. You didn't assess the child in advance to determine whether they needed it. You were part of none of those things, and yet you caused the child to have a lumbar puncture. Well, that's an interesting form of words. So, I don't know. I don't know. But I suspect they wanted to get as much together as they could to throw everything in there in the hope that something would stick. So, the General Medical Council has become an instrument of the public health apparatchik for persecuting doctors, discrediting doctors in an effort to prevent them dissenting about vaccines and vaccine safety. And who knows what will happen to Richard Halvorsen? Will he be next? This is extraordinary to Americans, absolutely extraordinary to Americans, because in America you have the First Amendment, you have freedom of speech. If you can want to say something, you say it. In this country, no way. The idea of prosecuting a doctor because he said something, given his opinion, offered his advice, said what he truly believes, is absolute anathema to Americans. They can't understand how this could possibly happen in the civilized world, and yet here we have it. So did I. We are so far from living in a democracy, so far from. And this is a very, very important case in many ways. It sounds terribly pompous to say that, but actually orthodox medicine is on trial here. We, my colleagues and I, practice orthodox medicine based implicitly on the history of the patient, the physical examination of the patient, the correct clinical evaluation of the patient, making a diagnosis, treating that, the disease, and monitoring the patient. That is what we do, and that is the kind of medicine that should be practiced. And that is really being challenged now by when that comes into conflict with the beliefs, the diktat of public health. It is no longer in some way permissible to do that. So medicine is on trial, and if we lose and the position of the Department of Health is endorsed, their ability to persecute doctors in this way is upheld, then what happens in the future? What happens when there's a drug-related injury to a patient? What happens when a new complication emerges from a treatment or a vaccine? Doctors are going to say, it's too bad, sorry, not going to get involved. Because you've got a big pharmaceutical industry there with their friends in government that are going to come down on me and make my life misery. And it happened with thalidomide, and it's happened time and time and time again. Every time a doctor has put his head up above the parapet and said this vaccine or this drug is not safe, then his world has been turned upside down. Well, it's not a reason to walk away from it. In fact, it's every reason to fight it. Because otherwise we just hand over, just give up. Just hand over the world to the drug companies and walk away. Is their story, is the story of the parents being heard in all of this, either in the media or in the GMC or anywhere? Is it being listened to by doctors? No. Is it being heard in the media? not to the extent that represents what's actually going on, no. And the reason is that these parents are dealing with a catastrophe. They're dealing with a child who can't go out of the house, won't go out of the house. Screaming, having tantrums, beating their head against the wall, has got terrible diarrhea, is 15 years old and in nappies. No, they don't get out of the house. They don't have time to talk to the media. It's a select handful of the parents who actually are so determined and are of a particular mindset that they can do that. The rest of them are just coping with the catastrophe that's their world. And some think it's the MMR, some don't think it's the MMR. The problem is that parents with children with autism are not being heard, and yet the numbers are going through the roof. And it's different. In the day in AIDS, it was a very different story. AIDS is a very interesting analogy of an epidemic disease that has occurred in our lifetimes. And AIDS started in a homosexual community in San Francisco and Los Angeles, and in the radically right politics of Reagan and Thatcher, it was a gay plague, it was your fault, it's an act of God, it was anything but a transmissible agent, a virus. And so what happened was, with AIDS, is that people were stigmatized. That's your problem, you know, you've got, it's like leprosy, you get away from me, sort of thing. So people went underground, they continued their sexual practices, they didn't seek medical help, the virus spread like wildfire, and then 10 years later, when people acknowledge it's a virus, it's too late. It's too late. For thousands and thousands of people, it's too late. For three quarters of sub-Saharan Africa, it's too late. There was no imperative to produce vaccines or drugs or anything during that time because it wasn't perceived to be our problem. And then suddenly it appeared in blood transfusion recipients and hemophiliacs and heterosexuals, and suddenly it was a major problem. And what happened was the AIDS activists went and threw infected blood at officials. And the cameras came out, this is great, infected blood being thrown, take a picture of it, get it on the news. Suddenly politicians were embarrassed. And money started to flow and things changed. And so it was the pressure on the politicians and the change in perception that the media brought about because the activists did that, that really forced the pace of change. But these parents aren't like that. They're not AIDS activists. These are just ordinary folk trying to deal with a catastrophe in their lifetimes. They're not people who go out and throw infected blood. Maybe they should be. They're certainly getting angry enough now that something's going to happen. Something's going to break. And you just get a sense of it at that hearing, at the beginning of the hearing. But something has to change because there are so many of these kids and so few resources, so little true care available for them. And you hear it again at this hearing, time and again. This is a psychological problem. It's a psychiatric behavioral problem. Put them in a corner, sedate them, put them in a home, lock them up. No, it's not. It's a medical problem. It's a medical disease. It's treatable. It's understandable. You can investigate it. You can research it. And you can find out what's causing it if you want to. Nobody really wants to do that, apart from a few of us. So AIDS is an interesting parallel, and something, there was a kind of tipping point in AIDS, and it was around the time that people threw infected blood. Yeah, a lot of letters from GPs and psychiatrists and others saying, this is what happened to this child, and we're right with you, and where are you? Yeah, I don't see you, right? But that's okay. That's okay. I don't feel any antipathy towards them. It's just the human nature. Maybe they're not sufficiently persuaded that they're ready to come all the way out. Maybe many of the doctors I deal with are parents of affected children themselves. They know what happened. Sometimes they're still frightened to say. That I find a little difficult to swallow. Their own children have been damaged, and yet they're still keen to keep quiet about it.